This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yeis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the last couple of days have been to some of the worst conflict zones, but also the areas where peace is being rebuilt. And frankly, I am shocked by how vulnerable the situation is and how the country now is on the track to new conflict.
That's Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, speaking on the massive humanitarian needs and escalating violence in the Central African Republic. We'll have full details coming up.
Also, at least 25 people were killed when three car bombs went off outside a hotel in the Somali capital. And the Italian government is hosting an international conference on Libya, hoping to reach an agreement on unifying the country.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
The Norwegian Refugee Council, NRC, warns continued humanitarian and political neglect of the crisis in Central African Republic will lead to new catastrophes in the country. The Secretary General of the NRC, Jan Egeland, is touring the country and has found massive humanitarian needs and escalating violence against civilians and aid workers. He says thousands of single mothers are being raped each day because they live in camps surrounded by armed men and have no safe place to go. Next week, the UN Security Council will meet to renew the mandate of the peacekeeping force, MINUSCA, which is set to expire on November 15th. Egeland says CAR is now the world's third worst humanitarian crisis behind Yemen and Syria. He spoke with me from Bangui.
Well, I'm now in the capital of the Central African Republic, Bangui. The last couple of days have been to some of the worst conflict zones, but also the areas where peace is being rebuilt. And frankly, I am shocked by how vulnerable the situation is and how the country now is on the track to new conflict unless there is a much greater effort from international actors, from the neighboring countries, from the parties and the government inside to avoid new horrific war. Already, the civilian population is abused, displaced, women exposed to the most horrific sexual violence. And it's not once a month. It's every single day a number of places in the country. So it's shocking that it is so neglected and so forgotten, because this is one of the worst crises on earth.
Why do you think the international community has neglected the CAR?
In 2016, I remember vividly, many have forgotten, that there was a huge conference in Brussels that agreed on a concrete plan for reconciliation, peace and reconstruction of this country in the heart of Africa. Lots of money was pledged. The European Union that was hosting with the United Nations, other donors like the United States, said, we're really committed to turn a corner now here. We rely on a new democratically elected government. We hope and believe that the neighbors will help bring peace to the place, etc. Since then, it's been not going in the right direction. The neighbors of the country are bringing fuel to the fire. 80% of the country is under the rule of armed opposition groups. In the camps where I visited, single mothers with five children cannot leave the camp where they get some humanitarian assistance from us. If they visit the land that they had to flee from, they will be abused, killed, raped, etc. So next year, 2019, will be the year before new elections, and it's sort of the end of this period where one agreed to build peace and reconstruction here. I think really the European Union, the African Union, the UN Security Council, where the United States is the most important actor need to sit down with the neighbors of Central African Republic and with the government, everybody look in the eyes and say, we're failing the civilian population of the Central African Republic. Now we're heading straight into another horrific war engulfing the civilian population unless we invest much, much more in a peace process that functions in security and protection of the civilian population in a real nationwide humanitarian and developmental effort.
Also, I just wanted to briefly touch on the humanitarian aid workers. I understand that they're being attacked as well.
Indeed. I have 260 heroic colleagues in this country, and they are at risk all the time, really. In some areas, it's really too dangerous to do humanitarian work. It's one of the top three places on earth with attacks against humanitarian workers. A number of colleagues have been killed from other humanitarian organizations this year alone, and it's just a testament to the lawlessness. The way it is now, it cannot continue. We have to have an international effort to again bring attention to and a better effort to the Central African Republic.
That was the Secretary General of the NRC, Jan Eglant, speaking with me from Bangui, Central African Republic.
Witnesses say at least 25 people were killed when three car bombs went off minutes apart today outside a hotel in the Somali capital. A fourth blast went off as medical workers tried to rescue the injured. Police say four heavily armed attackers were shot dead as they tried to storm the Safi Hotel, located at a major intersection. At least 17 other people were injured. Most of the victims, who included two women and an 8-year-old child, who were passerbys and passengers in a minibus and several rickshaws. Security forces rescued dozens of people from hotel rooms. The Safi Hotel is across the street from the headquarters of Somalia's Criminal Investigation Department in Mogadishu. The militant group Al-Shabaab said it carried out the attack. The Al-Qaeda affiliate has been fighting to overthrow the internationally backed Somali government for over a decade. A witness who was inside the hotel said the front wall of the hotel building was largely destroyed by the explosions, which also blew out windows in other parts of the building.
The Italian government is hosting an international conference on Libya Monday and Tuesday, hoping to reach an agreement on unifying the country. Italian officials have briefed the four major Libyan leaders on Rome's proposal for bringing peace. The leaders are Fayez al-Sarraj, chairman of the Government of National Accord, Khalifa Haftar, commander of the Libyan National Army, and the heads of the House of Representatives and State Council, Akila Saleh and Khalid al-Mistiri. Imad Harb is the director of research and analysis at the Arab Center in Washington. He spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi about prospects for reaching a political solution to the Libyan crisis.
Any international effort to help in trying to resolve the Libyan issue is necessarily important. The question is, how will the Libyans themselves interact with each other, compromise with each other in this conference? Yes, the Italians can provide the venue, they can provide the programs, they can provide the meeting opportunities, but it is definitely up to the Libyans to really find a compromise.
Are you optimistic about the latest agreement between the Libyan factions?
It's definitely a very good agreement. Any agreement between Libyans is a good agreement. This one is, at least it brought together the House of Representatives and the higher state council to try to find a way of bridging the differences between them. The House of Representatives that does have gripes that it is supposedly it's the one that was elected by the Libyan people and it has an influence on how institutions really work. But the higher council also is one that is created by a Libyan political agreement. So both of them have the right to really contribute to this. And if they get to agree on certain conditions for moving forward, it's always good.
The Italian government said the first day of the conference on November 12 would focus on talks between the four Libyan leaders
right.
about security, economic situation, and postponing elections until 2019, scheduling it and agreeing on a legal framework to hold elections. Can this fix the problem of not signing an agreement in Paris last May?
Well, the agreement in Paris last May missed out a lot of people who did not participate in it. And now there is an opportunity for them to really get together again. The issue of the elections is a very important issue, but the problem is has always been that there is no legal definition of what is Libya today. I mean, what kind of a country is it? In other words, what I'm talking about is, what is the constitution for the country? How do elections fit into the political development of Libya today? So the agreement between the two factions, the Palermo conference, all of these things are really good, but there has to be some sort of a legal basis for the country. There has to be at least an agreement on some constitutional provisions for governing these elections.
Rome wants the representatives of the four Libyan sides to sign the plan that will be presented by the United Nations mission into Libya before members of the Security Council in the week after the conference is held. Could such agreement provide a new international pressure on the Libyan leaders to comply?
It depends on what happens in the conference itself. If there is hope that these different factions are going to really compromise with each other, yes, or by all means, the Security Council should assist in that. It'd be good. Again, the issue is also, will the Security Council be able to control also the outside actors in the Libyan problem? To tell the outside actors not to interfere in this affair that is between the Libyans, and to let the Libyans really decide and then come in and assist them in reaching the final solution.
That was Imad Harb with the Arab Center here in Washington. He was speaking with our colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawi.
The United Nations envoy on Libya says the country should hold a national conference on ending its conflict early next year, then organize elections in the spring. Ghassan Salami told the UN Security Council yesterday that Libya's House of Representatives had failed to pass legislation to amend the constitution and hold elections next month, as had been hoped. The United Nations had hoped the House of Representatives would be able to make progress in unifying the country's rival governments. Salami's comments indicate that the UN thinks the House of Representatives cannot achieve that goal and that it is time to give more Libyans a voice in achieving peace and unity for their nation.
Sunday, November 11th marks the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. An estimated 16 million military personnel and 21 million civilians lost their lives in the war. Many histories deal almost exclusively with Europe, where most of the fighting was, but there was fierce conflict in Africa, where Britain, France, Germany, and Belgium had colonies. In East Africa alone, an estimated 11,000 British troops died, along with nearly 90,000 Africans who fought as soldiers or served as porters and non-combatant helpers. To find out more about Africa's crucial part in World War I, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with historian Anne Sampson, who is in South Africa, in connection with her work as coordinator of the Great War in Africa Association.
Africa has generally tended to be forgotten in World War I because it was regarded as a sideshow to what was happening in Europe. And for those people in Africa, it wasn't a sideshow, it was real. Africa participated to a huge extent and had some of the longest campaigns of the war. Most of the military were volunteers at the start. Even when times got tough and they needed more men, the military preferred volunteers because they were more willing to do what soldiers do. For the general African, they enlisted for exactly the same reasons the men on the Western Front did. Economics, adventure, seeing new places, get away from the controlling family, spouse, chief, etc. Later on, we do have conscription, but that is mainly due for the carriers and porters, general labor.
I've read that there were four porters or servants assigned to each white officer, and that four enlisted men had to share one servant. Life must have been harder for the laborers. Did they die in greater numbers than the soldiers they served?
I mean, the proportion of people killed was the same across the board. Only 3% of men suffered from gunshot wounds, and 75 80%+ suffered from malnutrition and then diseases, malaria, black water fever, etc. And conditions were harsh. Diets were not as robust for the carrier, so they suffered quite a lot on that front. And being commandeered adds its own pressures.
And I've read that there was quite a bit of cruelty toward the carriers, who were often treated like animals or even worse. Was there any difference between the various colonizers in this regard?
We hear in West Africa, the German side, that there is a lot more physical violence than what we have in East Africa. And there are British officers as well, South African officers, who do mistreat their men. But we've also got stories where the Bishop of Zanzibar recruited a group of men to be carriers, and he marched with his men because he wanted to make sure that they got the best treatment that they could get.
Would you say that the African carriers and the soldiers made a significant contribution to the success of the Allied war effort?
Oh, yeah, the contribution is huge. We've got accounts of some of the white hunters who were serving in the First World War saying, if it wasn't for our black gun bearer, we would never have survived in Africa.
How were the Africans treated after the war? I know those who served the British were given pensions of some kind.
They were given pensions, one-off pensions. The Germans eventually stopped paying their guys in about 1964. The German commander and the governor, Schnee, had been fighting all those years to get the German askari, the monies that were owed to them from the First World War.
And after the war, of course, you had the Treaty of Versailles, which rearranged everything.
As we know, one of the first decisions made was over Germany not getting its colonies back. The mandate system then took a bit longer to come into play. It was agreed that all the German territories would become mandates, which meant that they weren't directly controlled by the imperial power. Boundaries were drawn, creating Rwanda and Burundi, and that then leads to the civil wars we have later on in the 90s.
You've written that the present troubles in Cameroon can be traced to the Treaty of Versailles. What is now Cameroon, of course, was German, and the Treaty of Versailles divided it between Great Britain and France.
And now, technically, Cameroon is one country, but we know that there's problems between the French-speaking and the English-speaking Cameroonians, which can be taken back to the decisions that were made in 1923.
I know you're in South Africa right now from England to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the end of the war. What do you think this commemoration is fundamentally about, sort of under the skin?
I think it's about recalling and trying to understand the contributions that these unknown numbers of people made, and we need to respect absolutely every single individual, male, female, child, who was caught up in this quagmire, not of their own making. They thought that they were fighting for a better world, even those that were conscripted. They were told life would be better economically, socially, benefits would be coming their way. And those aspirations didn't materialize.
Anne Sampson is an independent historian and the coordinator of the Great War in Africa Association. She spoke with Adam Phillips from South Africa.
A newspaper in Gabon has been suspended for an article saying the government has gone on autopilot since President Ali Bongo dropped out of public sight 2 weeks ago. The 59-year-old Bongo reportedly became sick October 24th while in Saudi Arabia for an economic summit. Officials say he has been ordered to have bed rest for severe fatigue, but his prolonged absence has created a rumor mill with suggestions that he had a stroke or might be dead. Top ruling party officials have urged the government to provide more details to reassure the public. The Dawn newspaper said the prime minister should be appointed interim president, saying the country is on a very dangerous autopilot. That description led the High Authority of Communications Watchdog to suspend the paper for 3 months and its editor-in-chief for 6 months. The watchdog also took a Cameroon TV station off the air in Gabon at the end of last month for reporting Bongo was dead.
Some young South Sudanese entrepreneurs are introducing local fashions to diverse communities across the country. The second edition of Nile Couture Fashion Show was held last weekend in Juba, and local designers were front and center. Some models who took part in the show say the event brings together different communities and promotes peaceful coexistence. Michael Latit has more for VOA from Juba.
South Sudanese singer Sarah Cipriano entertained the audience as models strutted down the runway to showcase the work of various designers at Logale House in Juba. Doris Keji, the founder of Nile Couture Fashion Show, says she's promoting locally made designs using African print, known as kitenga, for men and women in hopes that people will stop depending on foreign clothes. She says the civil war has hurt the local fashion industry.
If we have peace, the stability, we will have more, people will turn to think about, other than thinking about other problems like hunger, sickness, whatever, maybe we'll start thinking about things like, okay, fashion, I want to dress up, I want to do these things, so life will be good.
KG is encouraging young South Sudanese to think about specializing in fashion designs as part of the national effort to develop the country. South Sudanese designer Winnie Raymond says she is thrilled that fellow South Sudanese appreciated her designs in the show. Raymond hopes one day her designs will be appreciated overseas.
I'm seeing myself in the next near future or in future that my collection is going to be in New York, in Paris Fashion Week, New York Fashion Week, all over the world, international, not just so. I hope for the best, and I'm going to work on that.
Most of the 20 South Sudanese models in the show say they were happy to be part of an event that showcased local designers. 25-year-old male model Maur Lino says he was in the show to challenge the myth that modeling is reserved for women only. Lino says fashion shows can help change the image of South Sudan, which is often associated with war and food insecurity.
There are several ways of building up the country. It's not only by fiscal building like infrastructure and that kind of thing. Also modeling industries, we can build them up, show our culture like the way we are doing today. It's not that we need to focus always on white or Western culture. So we need to focus on our culture sometime also.
Some of those who attended the show say they were inspired by local designers. 23-year-old Helen Mangar says she hopes to become a fashion model and inspiring young South Sudanese girls. Mangar says she learned from interacting with some of the models that they hail from many different communities.
And once we get together and know each other and talk with each other, we learn that everybody else is just like you, and you can actually get to interact with them, and therefore that is promoting peace. If other people see you communicating with each other and socializing with each other, that brings peace.
27-year-old Juba resident Emma Jigi called the show as amazing. Jigi says she ended up going home with two blouses made by local designers.
It was beyond my expectations. The designs, that were designed were amazing. The models, the setup, and of course, definitely the location.
KG and Raymond say they plan to organize more fashion shows, which they hope will inspire more young South Sudanese to join the fashion industry. For VOA News, I am Michael Latit in Juba.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Vasco Volarich, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.